shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight I wanted to talk to you a bit about the prophet Jeremiah. Two of the prophets in the Bible were of the regular priesthood, Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And other than that, when God needed a man to stand up and say, "Thus saith Yahweh," he had to go outside the professional priesthood to find him, as is so often the case to this day. His name, in Hebrew, Yirmiyah, Yahweh will arise. You note that all of the great prophets had either Yah, the shortened form of Yahweh, or El, the mighty God, as part of their names. He was the son of Hilkiah, who was high priest. You remember reading that at a time of apostasy, things had gotten in a bad way. The temple had been pretty much taken over by pagan apostate priests. But one of the, at most, two or three good kings that the kingdom of Judah ever had, almost its only one, Josiah, was on the throne. And the temple was a mess. It was full of rubbish. It was badly in need of repair. And Josiah gave orders that the revenues should be used for cleaning up and repairing the temple. So Hilkiah, the high priest, tradition has it, he found it in a wooden chest in the treasury part of the temple. He found a complete book of the law, the first five books of the Bible. I don't know whether he found scrolls of the prophets or not, but at least there was the law. Now, the fact that only in cleaning up the rubbish did they find this shows the moral and religious state of the temple, as well as its dilapidation. So he took this, and it was shown to King Josiah. Now you remember, in giving the law, God said, "If you will do these things, you will be blessed in every way. You will have peace, prosperity, victory if you do have to have war, easy victory. You will have good health, long life, everything good. But if you violate my law, then you're going to have trouble. You will be at war with your neighbors, and you will have considerable trouble winning those wars. You will lose your prosperity. You will lose your good health. You're going to have trouble all the way down the line." Well, there comes a time, you know, if you ignore God's laws and you begin getting these penalties, when you look upon them as pretty much the normal thing. Now, today, there are an awful lot of people in poor health. Instead of wondering why, we just accept that as being part of the normal way we should expect it to be. We don't know how it could be otherwise unless we can take pounds of poisonous chemicals put out by the big Jewish drug industry. So they were that way then. They had their troubles, but how could it be otherwise? After all, the pagan nations had troubles too. Then this was read to King Josiah, and he saw that the troubles they were in were exactly those that were prophesied if the laws of God were violated. And furthermore, the prophecy indicated it was going to keep getting worse and worse until they got back on the beam again. Josiah was appalled at the state the nation was in, and he gave orders to bring a halt to the apostasy. Scattered around all through Jerusalem and in every village around it there in Judah, every little village and every neighborhood in Jerusalem had some sort of a pagan shrine where they were worshiping one of the pagan gods. So Josiah cleaned those up in very short time, and he brought them back to the worship of the one true God. What most people don't seem to understand is that the laws of God are natural laws, just as much so as the law of gravitation. And they are all just as self-executing. If you jump out of an eight-story window, you don't violate the law of gravity. You obey it, you come down. But you do it the hard way, and you pay the penalty for violating the law. If you rode down in the elevator, you'd be obeying it the easy way and getting the benefit. And it is true with all these other laws of God that they are self-enforcing. For example, the agricultural laws. You remember one of these was this. When you plant a fruit tree, the first 3 years, you must not allow any fruit to form on the tree at all. Pinch off every bud before it can develop into fruit. The fourth year, you may allow fruit to develop if you wish, but none for you. It's too early to get hoggish. If you allow any fruit to form, you must bring it all to the temple as an offering. Now, the fifth year and thereafter, you can have that crop. That's yours. But we're too hoggish to do it, and we lose. Some years ago, a friend of mine who owned a little ranch up near Escondido, he and his next-door neighbor planted orange groves the same time. Now, their lands were adjoining on the same side of the same hill. They had the same slope, the same exposure to the weather, the same soil, nothing but a wire fence separating them, and they were planted at the same time. I saw this at the time the fifth year's crop was forming on their trees. Now, from the time those orange trees were as big as fair-sized weeds, the neighbor had been eagerly coaxing all the fruit he could get off of it. His trees weren't very big. They had thin, spindly branches. They had a very modest crop of oranges forming on them, but under every one of these thin branches was a board prop holding it up so it wouldn't break under the weight of a few oranges. Now, my friend's trees looked as though they were fully twice as old as his neighbor's. They were much bigger, great, thick, strong branches, and the crop of oranges forming on them at that time was, far more than double what his neighbor had per tree. In other words, taking the first 5 years together, my friend was getting actually more crop in that one fifth year than his neighbor had gotten in the 5 years put together. Furthermore, he had sound, healthy trees that were always going to give him that kind of a crop. Now, the Bible never argues with you why you should do these things. God tells you, do certain things and you will prosper. Don't do them and you're going to have trouble. Another one of these agricultural laws said that every seventh year you had to let your land lie fallow. Not just pour on a lot of chemical fertilizer. 6 years you could get your crop. The seventh year you had to let it alone, let it rest. And we've been too greedy to do it. And the result was what we saw in the Dust Bowl conditions back around 1930, which is exactly what the Bible prophesied for violation of it. It said, your heaven shall be like brass, and your rain shall be powder and dust. And that's what it was. Now, there's another thing beyond that. You read the articles about what they call the hidden hunger, that we are raising crops on worn-out soil And the plants cannot extract from the soil what is no longer in it. And the food we get is not as good as it should be. And as the Bible said, you shall eat and you shall still be hungry. Now, why? The Bible didn't bother arguing with you, but today we know the reason. The plants have to extract minerals from the soil. And the only minerals they can get are those that are in water-soluble form. Now you take pure river bottom sand, quartz sand, it's all mineral. But you get some nice, clean, washed river bottom sand and plant a seed in that and water it with distilled water so you're not giving it the minerals from another source. Make it try to get minerals out of that sand, and a plant will spring up, and it'll be sickly, and it will die, because it can't get any mineral out of that quartz, which is all mineral. It's not water soluble. Now, there live in the soil enormous numbers of bacteria, and as a byproduct of their existence, they produce certain acids. And these acids corrode away the surface of the sand grains and break them down into water-soluble mineral compounds that the plants can take up. Now, for thousands of years, we bred our plants for heavy yield, and that means drawing heavily on the soil for food. Now, you start out with what you might call a bank account of soluble minerals in the soil. But you are taking out of it every year a lot more than the bacteria can replace that same year. And at the end of 6 years, you've overdrawn your bank account. Now let it alone. Don't plant anything. And give the bacteria a year in which to make a new deposit in your bank account in the soil. Then you start the next 6 years, and there's something for your plants to feed on. So all these natural laws, the agricultural laws, the dietary laws, the economic laws, all are natural laws. So Josiah saw that the troubles they had in all these fields were exactly what the Bible had predicted for violation of God's law. And he gave the country one of its few periods of good rule. He brought them back quickly to worship of the one true God and obedience to God's law. Now, about 5 or 6 years prior to that time, the prophet Jeremiah had been called to his ministry. The priests began their service, their active service, at the age of 30. Up to that time, it was study. You remember, true to that, Jesus Christ did not begin his ministry until the age 30. Then they conducted their active work as priests serving in the temple until the age 50. After that, they retired from the ordinary temple duties and they became the teachers. They were teaching not only the new crop of young priests growing up, but they were to teach all the people the laws of God and how they should live in order to gain God's blessing. So this matter of the finding of the books of the law there, Jeremiah refers to that in Jeremiah 15, verse 16. For he says, "Thy words were found, and I did eat them, and thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of mine heart. For I am called by thy name, O Yahweh, God of hosts." Now, you run into there a common biblical expression. When he says, "Thy words were found and I did eat them," of course, he doesn't mean he gnawed on some old dry parchment leather. But when you eat food, it is digested, it's carried by the blood into every cell of your body, and it becomes a part of you. And these words had been digested in his mind till they had become a part of his mind and soul. You remember that when Jesus Christ said to the Jews that unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in me, they couldn't understand that at all. They never did know the Bible. All they ever knew was the Talmud. But he was using an expression that should have been quite familiar to them if they had paid any attention to the scriptures. Jeremiah 1, verses 5 and 6. God called him to be a prophet. God said, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee and ordained thee a prophet unto the nations. Then said I, Ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child." Now, he meant merely by this he was not yet 30 and ready for the ordinary beginning of a conventional priesthood. Some of the greatest of the prophets have been that same way. They weren't rushing out to eagerly take upon themselves what they knew to be the tremendous responsibility of being a prophet. You remember when God called Moses. Moses said, "Oh, send somebody else. I'm not a good speaker." And he pretty near got himself in difficulties with God. But God finally said, "Well, all right, I'll let your brother Aaron do the talking for you, but you go out and do the job I want done." Now, Jeremiah was called to be a prophet in the year 623 B.C., and he prophesied for 40 years in Judah, in and around Jerusalem. And it's interesting to note, through Jeremiah, more than most of the prophets, God was trying to bring this kingdom of Jerusalem back to its senses so they could be saved. And 40 years was this probationary period they had. And at the end of that time came the final destruction of the city under Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the deportation of the people into the Babylonian captivity. When they came back from Babylonian captivity with a lot of hangers-on with them and into a land still filled with the corrupt Canaanites, and they set up the ill-fated little kingdom for the disastrous future that Daniel had prophesied to complete the transgression, you note that from the crucifixion of Jesus Christ in the year 30 A.D., they had 40 years until the destruction of the city by the Romans under Titus and the dispersion of the people, some taken as slaves and the rest driven out. Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem the first time around 606 B.C. By about 604 B.C., there was the first deportation of a portion of the people to Babylon. He took with him those who could be leaders in rebellion, feeling that with them gone, the rest of the people would probably live up to the treaty they had made to be a tributary kingdom subject to Babylon. The final conquest and deportation was about 585 B.C. So you can see Jeremiah's ministry began before the first conquest of Jerusalem and continued there until the final one in 585 B.C. Other prophets contemporary with him included Daniel, who was in Babylon. Daniel had been taken there in the first deportation. Likewise, Ezekiel, who was taken to Babylon in the first deportation. The prophet Habakkuk gave his prophecies in Judah in 626 B.C., making him substantially a contemporary of Jeremiah 3 years earlier. Zephaniah had prophesied in Judah in the year 630 A.D. And it is entirely possible, you might almost say probable, that Obadiah was also a contemporary. Now, if you look in your Bible and see dating assigned to the book of Obadiah by Archbishop Usher, you'll see how completely erroneous it has to be. Usher gave him the dating of 887 B.C. But you read your book of Obadiah, and it is entirely a denunciation of the Edomites for having assisted in the Babylonian conquest and deportation of the people of Judah. And that didn't occur until, as I say, about 606-604 A.D. and finished 585 A.D. Now, he doesn't talk about it as giving a prophecy that this would come in the future. Obadiah is denouncing the Edomites for what they have already done. So the dating necessarily would put him as a contemporary of Jeremiah. As everybody knew, the prophets were not popular people. Pretty near all of them were murdered. Now, the man who says, look, what you're doing is wrong. You're getting yourself into trouble, you're getting the nation into trouble, and the whole thing is going to be bad unless you straighten up and behave. That man is never popular. So Jeremiah, having known about many earlier prophets who were martyred, was not eager to rush into this at all. He knew what he'd be getting into. But when he said, I cannot speak for I am a child, God's reply was this, say not, I am a child, for thou shalt go to all that I shall send thee, and wherever I command thee thou shalt speak. Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee to deliver thee, saith Yahweh. Then Yahweh put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and said unto me, behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms. Now note what his assignment was. To root out and to pull down, and to destroy and to throw down, and to build and to plant. Now, the book of Jeremiah in the Bible only traces him into Egypt after the final Babylonian deportation of most of the people, when a few of the rebels ran away to Egypt and compelled Jeremiah to go along with them. What always arouses my indignation about the ordinary churchmen is their eagerness to proclaim that the God to whom they give lip service is a liar. Unmistakably and theoretically, they had read the Bible when they were in their theological seminary. God gave Jeremiah the job not only to pull down some of the existing nations and institutions, but he said also to build and to plant. And as far as the Bible traces him in the book of Isaiah, he had not yet built or planted anything. So what do these seminary-taught ministers say? Jeremiah is the pit of doom. He died in Egypt in exile. In other words, he never completed the thing that God said he was going to do. Well, I've told you on other occasions about the pretty clear evidence we have that Jeremiah, with the daughter of Zedekiah, the last king, Jeremiah left Egypt with her and took her to Ireland, where there was on the throne there a king of Judah lineage, so that the two halves of the true Judah line, the Pharisees and the Zara line, were united by that marriage. It's interesting to note that some years ago, a member of this San Diego congregation brought to my attention the fact that some member of her family had had the family genealogy run down and a book published on it. The family member who had this done had never heard of the Anglo-Saxon Israel identity doctrine and no doubt wouldn't have believed it if he had heard it. So it wasn't a matter of wishful thinking and telling the genealogist come up with something to bolster my ideas. But the genealogist found that one of their ancestors had come to Ireland in the party with the prophet Jeremiah. And this particular ancestor's job He was custodian of the stone, which is in the coronation chair today in Westminster Abbey, the stone of scone. The job of being a prophet was a dangerous and thankless and unpleasant one, and God didn't let him out of that. But he said this, "For behold, I have made thee this day a fortified city and an iron pillar and brazen walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against the princes thereof, against the priests thereof, and against the people of the land. And they shall fight against thee, but they shall not prevail against thee, for I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to deliver thee." And incidentally, all those named, the kings, the princes, the priests, and the people, did fight against Jeremiah and even on occasion tried to kill him, but they never succeeded. Now, you will remember that there were actually 13 tribes of Israel, because one of the original 12, that of Joseph, had been subdivided into two, the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. When they got into the country, the land was divided up so that each of 12 tribes had its own territorial area where that tribe was concentrated together. But one of the original tribes, Levi, was not given any land of its own. They were assigned certain cities, but not farming areas. Their job was not to be farmers. The tribe of Levi made up the priesthood, and the priests in those days were not merely the ones who served at the altar in the temple. They were the whole civil service of the nation. They were the administrators, the teachers, the judges. So, while there were some cities where they were concentrated somewhat, there was supposed to be no village in the whole land that did not have its Levite there as judge, an advisor, and administrator. When the religion became corrupted and paganism revived in the land, a lot of these priests scattered throughout the land set up pagan shrines in their hometown. And, of course, as head of the shrine, why, they made a very comfortable income out of this. So they were very much in business for themselves as pagan priests. And naturally, when Hilkiah and Jeremiah induced the king Josiah to break up this paganism, why, it didn't sit well with these apostate Levites who were heading their pagan shrine. The hometown of Jeremiah was Anathoth, a little village about 2.5 miles northeast of Jerusalem. Though there is perhaps some reason to believe that his family also had land in another village, Libnah, which was another of the towns assigned to the Levites. In 2 Kings 23, verses 4 to 13, we read about this reform. And the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the priests of the door, to bring forth out of the temple of Yahweh all the vessels that were made for Baal, and for the grove, and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron, and carried the ashes of them unto Bethel. And he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and in the places around Jerusalem. Also them that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun, unto the moon, unto the planets, and to all the host of heaven. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense from Geba to Beersheba, and broke down the high places of the gates that were in the entering in of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on a man's left hand at the gate of the city. Nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entering in of the house of Yahweh, and burned the chariots of the sun with fire. And the altars that were on the top of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars which King Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of Yahweh, did the king beat down, and broke them down from thence, and cast the dust of them into the brook Kidron. Pagan altars within the courts of the temple, and the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had built for Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Sidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and for Milcom, the abomination of Ammon, them did the king defile. Jeremiah found himself immediately unpopular, therefore, with these Levites who lived in his hometown of Anathoth. And they warned him, if you don't stop prophesying trouble for apostasy, we're going to kill you. Now the political leaders, the princes, were against him. First, he condemned their dishonesty, tyranny, and idolatry. And for another thing, he had gone at least twice as far as the river Euphrates. And obviously, he must have visited Babylon while he was there. Daniel was his friend and would have introduced him to Nebuchadnezzar, because Daniel stood high in the councils of Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah chapter 13 tells of his trips to, he doesn't mention Babylon, but he does mention to the river Euphrates. So this was about 602 B.C., between the two deportations. Also, it records that in 596 B.C., he wrote a letter to the people who had been deported to Babylon. This is 29th chapter of Jeremiah, telling them, don't let any so-called prophets among you get your hopes raised that you're coming back right away. You're not. You will have to remain 70 years in Babylon before God lets you return. So settle down and try to make something of yourselves during that period. From this, of course, he was suspected of treason. They said he's conniving with Nebuchadnezzar for the overthrow of the kingdom of Jerusalem. Now the common people hated him because he condemned their idolatry. Biblical religion is austere. It doesn't have all the interesting fornication festivals of the pagan religions, which the people liked so well. And when he condemned them for turning to idolatry, which was strictly designed to meet the people's desires for lower standards, and they had no guilty conscience, when he condemned this, the whole people turned against him. They had been worshiping, among other pagans, the Queen of Heaven. Now, the Queen of Heaven was the pagan goddess Ishtar. And when you trace back the origin of that, you find that Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, was extremely wicked, but extremely able. Nimrod had led the people of Babylon into every kind of wickedness and pagan idolatry. And when he was killed, instead of letting everything fall apart, Semiramis took over with a firm hand and kept the kingdom going. And she said that Nimrod had died for the people, was their savior, and he was now to be worshipped as a god in heaven. The next child that she bore, whose we don't know, she said this was the reincarnation of Nimrod. Now, as the wife of Nimrod, the god, she was queen of heaven. As the mother of the reincarnated Nimrod, she was the mother of God. In other words, those are the Catholic doctrines and where they come from. And still, today, the Catholic Church worships the Queen of Heaven with their general congregation utterly ignorant of where their priesthood got the doctrines. Now, Jeremiah was bitterly denouncing this paganism, and this was something quite popular with the people. After the final overthrow in 586 B.C. and the deportation 585, he was still telling the people, this has come upon you because you're apostates to paganism. And they were saying, well, as long as we worship the Queen of Heaven, we had peace and prosperity. Now that we neglected this, as you told us, why, look what's happened to us. Jeremiah, the 44th chapter, tells us that. Poor Jeremiah, he was running into trouble on every side. The princes were against him, and through them the king, Zedekiah. The highest praise you could give him was to say he was an unprincipled weakling. When the princes put pressure on him to do evil, he went along with it. The priests and the people. In the 11th chapter of Jeremiah, he's running with astonishment into all this resistance. He says, "But I was like a lamb or an ox that is brought to the slaughter, and I knew not that they had devised devices against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with the fruits thereof, and let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be no more remembered." So God says this, "Therefore, thus saith Yahweh, of the men of Anathoth that seek thy life, saying, prophesy not in the name of Yahweh, that thou die not by our hand. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will punish them. The young men shall die by the sword, their sons and their daughters shall die by famine, and there shall be no remnant of them. For I will bring calamity upon the men of Anathoth, even the year of their visitation." All through this period, the kingdom of Judah, when it was first conquered by Babylon, had been reduced to a tributary kingdom. They had to pay a heavy tribute tax to Babylon and swear that they would be faithful to the Babylonian rulers. Well, naturally, that doesn't sit well with anybody, and the weakling king on the throne didn't like the idea that he wasn't an absolute monarch able to do anything he wanted to, and he and his princes were conspiring with the king of Egypt. Now, the Pharaoh of Egypt didn't like Babylonian power right at his doorstep like that. Naturally enough. So he was constantly conspiring with the kings of the little city-states in Palestine to revolt against Babylon and saying, "I'll help you, I'll send the Egyptian army off to help you." Now all this time, Jeremiah was giving warning. This conspiracy is going to fail. Egypt won't be of any use to you. You're going to bring upon yourself disaster. Now, Egypt, a couple of centuries before that, had been one of the great world empires. And why were they of no use now? During all the centuries, several thousand years, in fact, of Egypt's greatness, they were a pure white people. Their beautiful portrait sculptures show us that. In fact, while they were in Africa, they were not African in any Negroid sense at all. During all that period, any free Negro found in Egypt was summarily killed on sight. Nobody bothered to ask him, "What are you doing here?" because he couldn't possibly have any lawful business there. There were a few black slaves working in chains out in the field, but no free Negroes. Then, oh, somewhere around 775 B.C., disaster hit. Now, some of the early kingdoms finally realized that on the death of the king, sometimes the kingdom was up for grabs because the crown prince hadn't yet demonstrated any particular ability. He hadn't gained the loyalty of the army. And any army officer who could get the backing of a substantial part of the troops might seize the throne. Therefore, several of them, including Babylon and Egypt, finally came to the idea that the king would appoint his oldest son co-regent with him as soon as the boy became old enough that he might be able to do something useful and to gain the respect of the officers who worked under him. So that for the last several years of his father's reign, the crown prince was sharing the authority of the kingdom with him, and when his father died, the son already had the power of the throne and the loyalty and respect of the officers under him. And they did very often in that way succeed in getting an orderly transition to power. But not always, because the co-regent crown prince sometimes just couldn't make the grade. And that's what happened in Egypt back around 775 B.C. Prior to that time, Egypt had conquered what they then called Nubia. It took in what today we call the Sudan, and perhaps a bit beyond that into Ethiopia, Negro population. Egypt had conquered Nubia. And not only did they take a lot of Negroes as slaves to work in Egypt, but here were a lot of big, husky Negroes, not brains enough to be afraid of anything, and they drafted them into the Egyptian army. Why should we go out and get killed when we can get these foreigners to be mercenary troops for us? You know, Rome finally reached the point where she had to do that, and the fall of Rome came pretty speedily after it. So, the Pharaoh of Egypt died, and the throne was up for grabs, and the Egyptian officer in charge of Nubia had a big army of these Negro troops. And he marched swiftly north and seized Egypt with his Negro army. His dynasty, propped up by the sword of his Negro troops, his dynasty held the throne for about 75 years. And by the end of that time, Egypt was a mulatto nation. The greatness of Egypt in every respect ended at that time. Their art and architecture was of no consequence after that. Up to that time, they had been one of the great world empires. From then on, they were kicked around by any military adventurer who could raise anything more than a half-pint army with which to invade and conquer Egypt. So Jeremiah said, "You fools, you're relying on this mulatto nation to strengthen you when you were under attack by the greatest empire in the world, Babylon. It isn't going to work." And here was the man who had been twice back, presumably, to Babylon. And it's worthy of note, by the way, that in the final conquest and deportation of Jerusalem, it records Jeremiah 39, verse 11 to 40, verse 5, that Nebuchadnezzar had given special instructions to his generals to take good care of Jeremiah when they captured the city. So the princes said, "You're conspiring with our enemy." Jeremiah 26 records it. "Now it came to pass, when Jeremiah had made an end of speaking all that Yahweh had commanded him to speak unto all the people, that the priests and the prophets and all the people seized him, saying, 'Thou shalt surely die. Why hast thou prophesied in the name of Yahweh, saying, This house, the temple, shall be like Shiloh, and this city shall be desolate without an inhabitant?' And all the people were gathered against Jeremiah in the house of Yahweh. When the princes heard these things, they came up from the king's house unto the house of Yahweh, and sat down in the entry of the new gate of Yahweh's house. Then spake the priests and the prophets unto the princes and all the people, saying, 'This man is worthy to die, for he has prophesied against this city, as ye have heard with your own ears.'" So there was quite a debate over it. Jeremiah defended himself. "Then spake Jeremiah unto all the princes and to all the people, saying, 'Yahweh sent me to prophesy against this house and against this city all the words that ye have heard. Therefore now amend your ways and your doings, and obey the voice of Yahweh your God, and Yahweh will repent him of the calamity that he has pronounced upon you. But know ye for certain that if ye put me to death, ye shall surely bring innocent blood upon yourselves and upon this city. For of a truth, Yahweh hath sent me unto you to speak all these words in your ears." So they held a debate. Some of them cited the case of the prophet Micah, who had similarly prophesied disaster and had not been murdered because he was speaking in the name of God. others cited a prophet named Uriah, who had been put to death by orders of the king on such an account. But finally, he was acquitted. Then said the princes unto all the people, unto the priests and to the prophets, this man is not worthy to die, for he has spoken to us in the name of Yahweh our God. One reason for his high standing, when it really came down to the pinch there, was that he may have been related to the king. The last king of Judah, Zedekiah, was the son of Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. Now, if Jeremiah of Libna is the same person as Jeremiah of Anathoth, and those are both Levite cities and fairly close together, why then he was the grandfather of Zedekiah. Now, we don't know to a certainty, but it's a possibility there. We all know, of course, of Zedekiah's fate because he wouldn't listen to Jeremiah. Now, the churches have made us acquainted with Jeremiah's prophecies of doom. He was telling the people how he worried over what was happening. How he said, I'm weeping for what I know is going to come to you. And they call him the weeping prophet and so on. We know also that he prophesied the future glory of Israel, not Judah, Israel. Now remember, the people of the northern kingdom of Israel had gone into the Babylonian captivity and disappeared from the Bible record by 715 B.C. at the latest. And here, a little over a century later, Jeremiah was prophesying the magnificent future of Israel. But there's one thing that I don't believe we have had called to our attention very often, and that is that Jeremiah also was prophesying the coming of Christianity. It's interesting, you find this in the 30th chapter of Jeremiah. Therefore, fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith Yahweh, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar. Remember now, this was practically a century and a quarter after they had disappeared from any historical record in the Bible. For I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of thy captivity. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and not leave thee altogether unpunished. Thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will bring back the captivity of Jacob's tents, and have mercy on his dwelling places. And their nobles shall be of themselves, and their governors shall proceed from the midst of them. And ye shall be my people, and I will be your God. Thus saith Yahweh, the people who were left from the sword found grace in the wilderness. Now remember, the grace of God is Paul's favorite theme. That's what he's always talking about. You have been trying to get the approval of God by earning it, by living up to the law. And you haven't succeeded, and you couldn't succeed. The favor of God comes by his grace as a gift to us. The people who are left of the sword found grace in the wilderness. Now, the people of Israel, known as Scythians from the time they were settled around the southern end of the Caspian Sea, when they started their march on up into Europe, they were in the wilderness. Because as soon as they got far up the Danube Valley, they were getting into the great forested countries of Germany, Austria, the upper Balkan countries, up along the Baltic Sea. This was wilderness. The people of Judah in captivity in Babylon would have had hundreds of miles to travel to find a wilderness anywhere. The people which were left of the sword found grace in the wilderness, even Israel. When I went to cause him to rest. I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. And you can't make that apply to Judah. Hear the word of Yahweh, all ye nations, and declare it in the isles far off. the British Isles to which they came, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd doth his flock, for Yahweh hath redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, although I was a husband unto them, saith Yahweh. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. In other words, instead of compulsory obedience to law as a matter of form and lip service, it would be the voluntary obedience to the will of God coming from the heart. Now, this whole last passage that I've read to you there is quoted word for word in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, Hebrews 8, verses 6 to 13. They're quoting Jeremiah word to word on that as proof that this was what God had prophesied the coming Christianity would be. So Jeremiah was not only the prophet of doom, Jeremiah was not only the one who kept the throne of David in existence, transferring it to Ireland, where the Milesians were in charge, but Jeremiah was also one of the first to prophesy of Christianity. Now, Isaiah, who prophesied somewhat earlier than he, was the first who gave any detailed explanation of the coming of the Savior and what he would do and so on. But what the results were going to be was told by Jeremiah. It's an interesting book to read. The other prophets give you very little picture of themselves. They tell you, thus saith Yahweh, and they make their message clear enough. But as the man himself, you don't get much understanding. But Jeremiah gives you a picture of the man himself that's very interesting. You'll find it worth reading for that, the way he held up as well as he could under the tremendous troubles poured on him. They had some great men in those days, even if, as always, they hated them for their greatness. Jeremiah was one of the extremely few prophets who was not murdered for his pains. We know that he died peaceably in his old age in Ireland after taking Zedekiah's daughter, the Princess Teotepi, to Ireland and seeing her safely married to the Irish king. See, you had the Milesian dynasty on the throne in Ireland. Before they left Egypt in the Exodus, one part of the tribe of Judah had already made a considerable exodus of its own. You remember that Judah left one half-breed son, Shelah, whose descendants were a source of trouble forever thereafter, but he left twin sons, illegitimately born, but purebred, Phares and Zarah. Well, twins are not born simultaneously, and Phares was the firstborn of the two. So that carried with it the right to the throne. Now, in those days, for an ambitious man to become president of Standard Oil Company was a little too difficult. If you had any real administrative ability, your only chance to use it was on the throne. Here were people of great ability in this Zarah half of Judah, and the door closed to advancement to them. So it's of record that a considerable number of them left Egypt well before the Exodus. They went up the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. Some of them settled in Greece. Some settled on the mainland of Asia Minor, where they founded the city of Troy, and they founded the city of Miletus. And Miletus became a very important city. They had their own gold coinage, and stamped, by the way, with the lion of the tribe of Judah, before Tyre and Sidon became the great popular merchant cities and established colonies, Milesia established colonies in a number of places around the Mediterranean, and especially they built a strong and powerful colony in Spain. Milesian troops were hired by the Egyptians as mercenary soldiers for border guards. From their settlement in Spain, the Milesians invaded Ireland and conquered it and became a ruling class there. As a matter of fact, the Milesians were the ruling class until they were conquered by the English kings, sometime in the 1200s, as I remember it. And those Irish whose names begin with Mac or with O can trace their lineage to these Milesians. So there you had, established in Ireland, a throne occupied by a descendant of Zarah, half of Judah. Now the kings in Jerusalem were from the Pharisees part of the tribe. So when Zedekiah's daughter was married to Eochaid, the Harriman in Ireland, you had the two king lines of Judah united in one on the throne. From there, they settled Scotland. In fact, for many centuries, Ireland was known as Scotia Major, and Scotland was Scotia Minor. Later, the Irish dropped the Scot name, and the people in the northern half of the English island, adopted it and called it Scotland. Now that is why when Fergus, the Scottish king, was crowned, there was no objection to taking this stone on which the kings were crowned from Ireland to Scotland. These were the same people. This was part of the same royal family. And so it was taken there. And you remember from there, the English, capturing Scotland, captured the Stone of Scone, and took it to Westminster Abbey. But you remember, it was not too long after that, that a Scottish dynasty succeeded to the throne of England. So you had the king line of David ruling always over some part of the Israel people.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.